The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Medical Cures in the Talmud, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas Basia Menucha Bas Yaakov, Aleho HaSholem, Mrs. Bernice Markowitz Gersh of blessed memory.
Health, sickness, and medicine are a major subject throughout the Talmud. Not only is medical intervention allowed by Jewish law, but it is also mandated as well. In the handout, on the first page in paragraph A, we quote the Gemara in Brochus in Samach Omad Aleph in 60a, where the Talmud quotes a prayer that is said when a phlebotomy, when blood is taken, which was an accepted medicinal procedure up until some 200 years ago. In that prayer, there's an excuse made. And the end of that prayer is that we ask you for the help. Since it is not the proper way for men to heal, but this is a habit with them. It's an excuse. We'd rather go directly to you. We're not up to it. Abaye, the famous Talmudic sage, counters this and says that's not the proper attitude towards medicine. In fact, one is allowed, one does not need any excuses, one is allowed to seek help through a physician. Rashi explains the first position, why they deemed it not to be preferable, or really it's a bidyeved, it's something that one should really avoid going to doctors. And he explains, and this is really the quote from Bava Kamma here, since God caused the injury, it's only proper that God take it away. However, as the Talmud points out, that's not the proper way of looking at the situation. God may have created the situation, but we have to take a very proactive stance in trying to eliminate sickness. In fact, and this is the last, this is the quote in the bottom of the first page, the Medrash Bereishis Rabbah quotes from the Sefer Ben Sira that says that actually the world was created with the intention of creating medicines. In other words, the herbs that were created, the various forms of plant life. Actually, there's a Gemara in Shabbos and Ayin Zayin Amud Beis in 77b. Speaks about animal life. Were created with the intention that medicines be produced. So medication and the practice of medicine are really part and parcel of the Talmudic approach to life. We don't need excuses. Because it is permitted, it comes out of the category of something which is optional to something which is mandated, which takes us to page 2 on the top paragraph in paragraph C. If you see someone that is drowning, that's in danger, one is required to go and save him. There's a positive commandment, just as there's a commandment to return a lost object. There's a commandment to return a person back to his own health, and that there's a negative commandment of standing idly by when the life of your colleague is a danger. And this is how it is brought, and this is finally in paragraph D, this is how it is summed up by the Shulchan Aruch. This is the final word. The Torah gave permission for a doctor to heal, and in addition, it is a mitzvah, it's a requirement, included as part of the mitzvah of saving a life. By the way, the first position, the idea of faith healing, that we excuse ourselves from going into a doctor, is really a position that's not only held by those who are Christian Scientists, but there was a group of Jews, at one point a very large group of Jews, the Karoyim, the Karaites, that maintained, based on the verse, Ki ani Hashem roifecha, because I am the Lord who is thy healer, that one is not allowed to go to a doctor. I don't know if it's because of it's a mere coincidence, but the fact is there are only a few thousand of Karoyim left today. Based on these considerations, the Talmud is replete with advice for all kinds of illnesses, ranging from intestinal worms, jaundice, fevers and infections of all kinds, to earaches, eye diseases, delirium, and this is by no means exhaust the list. Some of these cures, involving ingesting or applying herbs, follows what is today standard medical practice. Others we would categorize as occult cures and seem very strange to modern ears. How are we to look at these Talmudic cures? It seems that by the high Middle Ages, in other words, from the year 900 to the year 1300, practitioners were unable to achieve the same results with the cures mentioned in the Talmud. Three explanations were offered by some of the most influential rabbis of the Middle Ages, and we quote them here on section 2 on page 2 of Changing Therapies. Tosfos in Moed Katan, in 11a, Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, maintained, and we quote here from the Tosfos, perhaps there have been changes in nature. Tosfos is referring to a statement in the Talmud about eating aged fish. Just as we see the therapies prescribed in the Talmud no longer are beneficial. Now, there's Tosfos recognized that the cures mentioned in the Talmud no longer worked. Tosfos attributed it to the fact, basically, of evolution. The Maharil, who was one of the great poskim, one of the great authorities of Jewish law in Germany in the late 1400s, the late 14th century, beginning of the 15th century, maintained that the Talmudic cures still work, except we don't know how to interpret those passages of the Talmud. And here we quote from the Maharil here on the bottom page 2. It is forbidden to test any of the cures and incantations mentioned in the entire Talmud, because we are not able to understand the essential meaning of the Talmudic text. And in the event that it is not successful, they will scorn and laugh at the words of the sages. In other words, the Maharil recognized that those cures no longer work. However, he attributed to our lack of understanding. Both the Tosfos and the Maharil assume that those cures actually did work in Talmudic times. There's a third body of opinion, which is we quote in the top of page 3. And this is a response of Rav Shriragon, which was found in the Cairo Geniza. The Cairo Geniza, there's a synagogue, it's called the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Fustat, which is Old Cairo, wherein was preserved hundreds and hundreds of years of documents from the Middle Ages, from the early Middle Ages on. And here we find a tshuva from Rav Shriragon, a response of Rav Shriragon, who lived in the 10th century. And a quote here, we have to inform you that the sages of the Talmud were not physicians, and they merely reported that which they saw and heard from patients that were cured. In other words, they were Talmudists, they were authorities of Torah. They understood the importance of medicine, and for that reason we said that's why the Talmud extensively quotes cures. But they didn't do original research. They accepted the research and the quotes of others. These are not matters of the commandments of the Torah, and therefore they don't have the same authority. And therefore we should not rely on these cures, nor should we implement them, lest we know through competent medical authorities they will not cause pain or endanger life. This is what our forefathers and elders have taught us. Basically saying, this is not my own opinion, but this is actually the opinion of the Rebbeim, of my teachers who have come before me. And actually this notion, this argument, so to speak, of how to view the Talmudic cures really reflects for the great a divergence of views of how to look at the Talmud's treatment of the occult. Those who follow the opinion of Rav Shuragon and those who come after her, afterwards, the Rambam, Rav Avram ben Arambam, the Meiri, all maintain, and we're going to quote from the Meiri later on, that occult cures actually do not work. And of course, there's the opinion of the Mekubolim, the Bali Tosvos, the Hasidim, the pious of Germany, the Hasidi Ashkenaz, that maintain that it does. One interesting variation of the Talmudic cure, which I don't believe medical science has explained as of yet, is something which is a common practice in Israel today. And that's the cure for hepatitis through use of pigeons. It's a very unusual practice. And how they sneak these pigeons into the hospitals. But they put the pigeons on top of the stomach area of the patient. And the pigeons begin heaving and expiring. And they die on top of the patient. And they use 1, 2, 3, sometimes 11 pigeons. And they notice, after the death of all these pigeons, a marked improvement in the patient. You know, gay vase. But it is... there may be, and really this goes into the study of alternative medicine, there may be things at work and energy forces at work that we still don't understand. But this controversy about Talmudic medicine and Talmudic therapies are only dealing with specific cures that are given to any one specific illness. However, there are certain basic underlying principles of therapy which are mentioned throughout the Talmud. These have withstood the test of time, and these therapies are the subject of today's lecture. And the first one, which we can... section 3, is psychosomatic therapies. What is the relationship between the psyche and the soma, between the mind and the body? The first quote we have is from a Gomorrah in Moed Katan, Chovov Omen Beis, about the importance when a person is ill, which is deathly ill, not to upset the patient. And if there's a death in the family, the patient should not be told. And even though other relatives of the patient are rising kriya, are tearing their clothes as a sign of mourning, it should not be done in the presence of the one who is sick, and the one who is sick should not be informed. They were very careful about not upsetting the patient, and they realize the relationship between the mindset of the patient and his eventual cure, longevity. On page 4, we quote what basically is a classic source, is a fascinating story. Chizkiah was the king of Yehuda. In the the standard dating system, he was king in Yehuda approximately in the year 700 of the Common Era. When he became sick, he was visited by Isaiah, Yeshaya HaNovi. And when Isaiah came to visit him, he chastised him. He rebuked him. And he went, he told Chizkiyahu HaMelech, says he told Chizkiyahu HaMelech, he told the king, set your house in order because you are considered dead and will not live. Chizkiyahu replied, says Yeshaya, Isaiah, common custom has it that someone who comes to visit the sick tells him, says heaven shall have mercy upon you. A doctor who comes to visit the sick gives him the advice, eat this, don't eat this, drink this, don't eat, drink this. Even if he sees him close to death, he doesn't tell him. He says, how could you tell me, set my house in order? How could you upset me this way? Evidently, and this is from the Medrash Rabbah, Kehelas Rabbah, Perek Hay, this is Medrash Vov. Evidently, it's important not to upset the person who is sick. His mind has a tremendous influence on the progress of his disease. On the other hand, the flip side of this is that not only should you not upset the person, but putting a person in a positive frame of mind could have a curative effect. And this is, we discussed before about occult cures. The idea of occult cures is not only a question of speculation, but it has real halachic implications. One is not allowed to, if one is not in an Erev, and one is walking Shabbos, one is not allowed to carry an amulet that has not been proven to be effective. However, if the amulet has been proven to be effective, one is allowed to wear it on Shabbos. And the question is, if one does not believe in the efficacy of occult cures, how can an amulet ever help? The Meiri offers the following explanation, and even one may disagree with the Meiri in particular as regards to amulets, but the basic principle holds true. And the idea, of course, is they believe that it helps. And if you believe something helps, and enough people are convinced that it will help, it actually will help. This is the opinion of the Meiri. It's interesting to note that Galen, almost 2,000 years ago, in his work, De Tumoribus, this is about tumors, identified the relationship between depression and cancer. More recent investigators have continued to elaborate the interplay between psyche and soma. One of the first studies of this kind was by Dr. Lashan, published in 1966 in the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences. He found that amongst 450 adult cancer patients, 72% were reported to have had a youth marked by feelings of isolation, neglect, and despair. Although a period of fulfilling and enjoyable relations were experienced in adulthood, prior to the onset of the cancer, the patient experienced a traumatic loss of a loved one. This life history pattern of 72% of the 450 cancer patients compares with 10% of the control group. These studies continue to be verified in both animal and human studies. Emotion and mood seems to count. And the effect of mood is not just confined to cancer. Enormous amounts of evidence demonstrate that if patients believe they're receiving an effective treatment, as we quoted from the Meiri, even if that treatment is a sugar pill, it works. That's the placebo effect. So the first Talmudic therapy is give your patients hope and lift up their mood. And the last quote we have here on page 4 is from the Rambam's treatise on asthma. There's a general rule, and I've seen great physicians acting on it, which is also in keeping with the medicine of Hippocrates and Galen, that the physician should not treat the disease, but the patient who is suffering from it. Practicing this therapy, the whole patient, may not be easy today. In today's environment and cost cuttings and HMOs, the doctor has less time to be with the patient. The patient often feels like a burden or a medical specimen. Ironically, it may be that these attempts to cut costs by dehumanizing the patient are really counterproductive. Without the time and hope that the doctor can provide to the patient could likely remain sicker longer and need extra care with resulting adding costs to the HMO. In other words, again, the first therapy is treat the whole patient, give the patient hope. Because the psychological mood has a definite effect on the longevity of the patient. And that's the first principle. Which brings us now to the second Talmudic therapy, faith in prayer. In a study of 30 women over the age of 65 who underwent hip surgery, which was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry in 1990, statistical evidence was found to show that women with strong religious beliefs were less depressed and were significantly more likely to recover sooner than their secular counterparts. Other studies have confirmed this. Referring to the relationship between religious belief and the importance of fostering religious belief and medical and physical well-being, David B. Larson, a former National Institute of Health psychiatrist, has cataloged many of the new studies which have found a correlation with deep religious belief and physical well-being. And he quotes, says, if a new health treatment were discovered that helped to reduce the rate of teenage suicide, prevent drug and alcohol abuse, improve treatment for depression, reduce recovery time from surgery, lower divorce rate, and enhance a sense of well-being, one would think that every physician in the country would be scrambling to try it. Yet what if critics denounced this treatment as harmful, despite research findings that showed it to be effective more than 80% of the time? Which would you be more ready to believe, the assertions of the critics based on their opinions or the result of clinical trials based upon research? What basically Dr. Larson is saying is that if one has strong religious beliefs, and those beliefs are not ridiculed, but are supported, in the long run, the patient will live a longer, happier, and more productive life. The Torah's position concurs with this research. But in addition, it seems that religious faith not only affects one's psychological well-being, but can actually show real results. And I'd like to go through the Talmudic sources of the efficacy of prayer. We quoted before about the importance of going to a doctor, not relying solely on prayer. However, prayer goes hand in hand with the practice of medicine. There is on page 5. We deal with the sources about the importance of prayer. We know about the importance of visiting the sick. On paragraph B, we see that it's important when you visit the sick to pray for the person. Not only, as we found in paragraph A, to actually help the person out, to make sure that the environment is sanitary, to revive the spirit, so to speak, of the patient. But it's important to pray. The Talmud seems to point out the fact that sometimes we pray that the patient should die, which is really a lecture in itself. But if there is hope, it's important to pray that the patient becomes well. In fact, there's an interesting story which is quoted here. We have in paragraph C, which is from a Gemara in Ksubas in Kuvdalad Amad Aleph 104a. The Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, the editor of the Mishnah, was dying. The rabbis were incessantly praying. His maidservant felt that it would be better for him in that condition not to continue life. You can't kill someone, but you could stop others from praying. And what she did is she went on the second story, she took a earthenware jar, she threw it down. It landed on the floor, made a tremendous noise. For a moment, the rabbi stopped praying. And at that moment, Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi died. In doing my reading and research about death and dying and near-death experiences, there's an amazing story, and I've read it in different forms, about people that actually were dying. In the process of dying, they were almost comatose. The members of the family were praying around the bedside. And the patient would get up for a moment and says, "Please stop praying, I can't die." They stopped praying, and the patient immediately died. Prayer helps. And in fact, as we find in paragraph D, that if one solely goes to a doctor and does not pray, it is considered a critique of the person. One of the great kings of Yehuda was Asa. Asa became sick in the 37th year of his reign. He had starting with his feet and progressing, this was the nature of his sickness. And in addition, he did not seek God, but rather the doctors. It was leveled as a criticism towards Asa. He should have prayed. So prayer goes hand in hand with seeking medical help. And it's really the Gemara in Bava Basra, which is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. This is the Gemara in Bava Basra in 116a. If there's someone who's sick, you should go to a scholar. That's brought in Shulchan Aruch from the Nemukei Yosef. You should go to the Rav of the city and ask for him to pray on behalf of the one who is sick. Again, says one of the Talmudic cures is prayer. In one 1969 triple blind study, a prayer intervention group prayed for 10 children with leukemia. Another 8 children served as the control group. One was asked in terms of the ethical nature of this experiment. But those 8 with leukemia were not prayed for. After a 15-month period, 7 out of 10 children in the prayer group were alive. Only 2 of the 8 in the control group were alive. Although the sample size of this study is very small, a new, larger, double-blind study taken in 1980 seemed to verify these results. This was taken in San Francisco by cardiologist Randolph Bird. There, 391 coronary care patients were chosen for this study. 192 were prayed for by prayer groups. 201 patients in the control group were not. Neither the doctors nor the patients of either groups knew who was being prayed for and who was not. The group that were prayed for had significantly fewer cases of congestive heart failure, cardiopulmonary arrest, as well as fewer cases of pneumonia. They also used less diuretics and antibiotics. They are now going to be able to replicate this study again, because there are questions of studies like that. Every parent prays for their child, and every relative. So it seems, how does one determine those who are not prayed for? And those, if you got a group of maybe 100, 200 communists You know, says, you know, as a control group, says, then maybe you know. So, but it is a fascinating study. According to the Medrash, though, even though praying that's done by others helps, the most effective prayer is when you pray yourself. And this is the story, of course, with Yishmo, that he was lost in the desert. He was extremely sick. The mother gave up hope for the child. She was praying. The child was praying, and the verse says that Hashem listened to the prayers of Yishmael. And as Rashi brings quotes the Medrash, because one's own prayers are much more effective. Again, the Talmudic, we say as a Talmudic therapy, is that prayer should be encouraged by your patients. Not only for the psychological benefits, but it would seem that prayer really helps. The third, we call the third Talmudic therapy, is preventive therapy. And here we quote from the Rambam. First, as we know from the Talmud, this is a Gemara, this is in Ksubas, in Lamed Omed Aleph, in 30a, everything is in the hands of heaven, except chutz mitzinim upachem, except for cold and heat. When you abuse your body, that's in your hands. There's a certain thing that God takes care of us, but God helps those that help themselves. And you have to take care of yourself. And as a result, the Rambam, and we quote here, it says on page 6 and 7, this is in section 5, says it's very important that one maintains a healthy lifestyle and one maintains one's well-being and health. In fact, the Rambam maintains that as part of the positive commandment, v'halachta b'drachav, you should walk in God's ways, because as the Rambam says, since it is the way of God that the body be healthy and perfect, for it is impossible to understand or know any of the knowledge of the Creator while being sick, it is necessary to distance oneself from things that destroy the body, to accustom oneself those things that strengthen and heal the body. And the Rambam goes on, and all of the fourth chapter of Hilchos Deos, to explain what is a healthful way of life in terms of eating and exercise and sleep. And he ends off, here this is in paragraph D, in any place where there's no physician, both the healthy and sick should not deviate from the rules described in this chapter, because each and every one of them, if observed correctly, will produce a beneficial outcome. In other words, the third Talmudic therapy is one should emphasize preventive medicine. Generally, we go to a doctor when things are difficult. We've already abused our body so much that we're coming, doctor, what should I do now? And I believe if one would, again, follow this Talmudic dictum, that there should be tremendous emphasis, which should be placed on people to maintain a bodily weight which maximizes one's longevity and health. To emphasize exercise and proper diet, and all those things that we know statistically will contribute to one's health and longevity. So let me just summarize what we've said about Talmudic therapies. We began to discuss specific Talmudic cures. We introduced the fact, of course, that it is a mitzvah to cure. It is a mitzvah to go to a doctor, and for a doctor to heal. Therefore, specific remedies are mentioned in the Talmud. However, again, there is a question about the efficacy of these remedies, if they were effective even in Talmudic times to the extent, or more certainly says today. But in general, says the basic principles of Talmudic medicine hold true today as they held true in Talmudic times. And that's A, says the importance of maintaining the psychological well-being of the patient and treating the whole patient. B, We see the efficacy of prayer. And the fact is that the patient should be encouraged to pray, both for the psychological benefit and for the real benefit of prayer, and as we see from these intriguing studies. And third, the importance of the emphasis of prophylactic medicine, this is preventive medicine, this is that one should maintain a healthful lifestyle, that one doesn't have to see a doctor. In that story, asking about the story about Chizkiyahu, the Gemara continues on in that. There's a Gemara in Brachas in Yud Omid Beis in 10b. It starts in 10a and 10b that he got up and prayed for himself and he was cured. he got completely better. You know, unfortunately, Yeshayahu's not in this room to answer that question. But I don't know if there's any mention of his response to that critique. But it's important to note that the Medrash captured that critique for us to learn from.
This lecture, titled The Medical Contributions of Maimonides and Nachmanides, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Basia Menucha Bas Yaakov Alecho Hosholem, Mrs. Bernice Markowitz Gersh of blessed memory.
Between the years 1000 and 1500, Spain and North Africa produced an abundance of intellectual and spiritual giants. Talmudists, biblical commentators, poets, grammarians, astronomers, and mystics. Not only did they influence and enlighten their own generation, but they left a rich legacy of works that are studied to this day. Perhaps the best known and the most influential personages of this golden age of Spain were two rabbis who were trained in the art and science of medicine. These two doctors had much in common. Both were recognized experts not only of Torah knowledge, but of general knowledge as well. Both created a plethora of works that became classics and are standard texts in every yeshiva. Both were physicians by profession, and both had the same first name, Moshe. One was Rav Moshe ben Maimon, known to the Jewish world as Rambam or Maimonides, and to the Arab world of his time as Abu Imram Musa ibn Maimon. The other was Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, known to the Jewish world as Ramban or Nachmanides. As similar as these two giants were, they were equally very different. Maimonides was a rationalist who held Aristotle and his philosophy in the highest regard. Nachmanides was a mystic, a Kabbalist who viewed Maimonides' rationalism as a foreign branch grafted onto the tree of Torah. Maimonides wrote not only for Jews, but for Gentiles as well. Many of the 10 medical treatises he wrote in his lifetime became standard medical texts in medieval Arab and Christian universities. A list of them is printed in the last page of our handout. And his Guide to the Perplexed, Mor Nevuchim, strongly influenced the non-Jewish philosophers Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas, as well as a host of others. Nachmanides, on the other hand, was a teacher for Jews alone, who wrote on a broad range of subjects, from his compendium on Halacha, practical Jewish law, his masterful commentaries on the Talmud, profound and much-used commentary on the Torah, to an inspiring mystic philosophy that he expressed in his many sermons and in his commentary on the Torah. However, another thing that both Maimonides and Nachmanides had in common is they left us a rich legacy of medical knowledge and ethics. A sample of that legacy is the topic of today's lecture. Before we begin, I would like everyone to turn to the timeline, which is in the back of this handout. And I'd like to review the salient parts of Maimonides' life. We'll first begin with a study of Maimonides and then on to Nachmanides. In 1135 in March, Moshe ben Maimon was born to his father. His mother died at childbirth. And his father Maimon, who was a dayan in the city of Cordova, a Talmud, a disciple of Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash, the greatest Talmudist of his time, raised his son single-handedly. And it seems was not only his father, but his teacher as well. In 1148, there was the Almohad, which was a fanatical Muslim sect in Morocco, conquered Cordova. They didn't tolerate, unlike the Muslims that had ruled Cordova and Andalusia up to that time, they did not tolerate religious pluralism. Rabbi Maimon, together with his son, was forced to flee. And they wandered southern Spain, went through North Africa, and after some 10 years, in 1158, they finally settled in Fez, Morocco. In 1165, as the Rambam was 30 years old, the Almohads conquered Fez, conquered that area, and again they were not able to practice Judaism openly, and they were forced to flee. And this time they went to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel. They went to Yerushalayim, to Hebron, and finally, after a year, they settled in Egypt. Shortly after they arrived in Egypt, Maimonides' father, Rabbi Maimon, died. And shortly after that, Rabbi Moshe's brother David, who supported the family, enabled his brother Moshe to continue his studies, was lost at sea, leaving a widow and many children. And Maimonides took it upon himself at that point to support not only his own family, but the family of his brother as well. He had studied, besides the Torah that he had studied, he was a student of medicine, but now was the first time he was forced to practice this as a profession, as a livelihood. But it seems that the majority of his day was still spent in studying Torah and writing. In 1168, this was some 15 years after he had begun this commentary, Maimonides finished his commentary to the Mishnah. In 1174, this was after he had been practicing medicine for some 8 years, Maimonides was appointed court physician to the vizier El-Fadhil. He was the vizier, he was the viceroy, he was equivalent to the vice president, to the Sultan Saladin, who was the who reconquered the Holy Land from the Crusaders. And it was during this time the Sultan was away at war that Maimonides was appointed. And again, it seems that he only spent a very small part of his day practicing medicine, because it was during this time that he composed the Mishneh Torah. In 1178, he finished, this is his grand, this is his magnum opus, the Yad HaChazaka, the Mishneh Torah, which was a compendium of the entire Torah Sheba'al Peh, the Oral Law. In 1190, he completed the Mora Nevuchim, which was a work directed to Jewish students of philosophy that were perplexed by the contradictions of Aristotelian philosophy and Judaism. In 1193, after the death of Saladin, when he was succeeded by his son Alaa ad-Din Nur ad-Din Ali, a person who was very different than his father, very pampered, a real playboy who suffered from depression. Here Maimonides was forced to spend the lion's share of his day treating the harem of the sultan and the sultan himself. In 1204, Maimonides was nifter, died, and he was buried in Tiberias in Israel. Besides that which he left us in Torah, the commentary to the Mishnah Torah, the Mor Nevuchim, the work of Sefer HaMitzvos, the work of the compendium of all the mitzvos and explanation, there's a wealth of responsa literature, the private letters. He wrote 10 works which are devoted to medicine. And again, I would like to just briefly go over them. First is a treatise on asthma, which we're going to quote from. This was written specifically for a member of the Sultan's court who suffered from asthma. But as the Rambam clearly states, he wanted a wider audience as well. Poisons and Their Antidotes was written at the behest of the vizier El-Fadhil. Egypt was plagued with snakes, and snake bites were very prevalent. It was at the Rambam's behest that there was a whole system of pharmacies that were set up in Egypt to provide antidotes for snake bites. In order that there would be a handy text available for any layman who is so bitten and who does not have an expert on call, he wrote this work. This work was translated, was originally written in Arabic, it was translated into Latin, and it was a standard text across the world. A third work, Aphorisms, was a synopsis of the Rambam's medical knowledge. He quotes widely from Galen, from the Arab doctors. He adds his own comments. It has 25 chapters. And again, we're going to touch upon this. The fourth, A Guide to Good Health, was written to the Sultan, the Alaf Dal Nur, who succeeded Saladin. And it was a guide to, hopefully, that he should. He had various health problems. He wrote a commentary, it's probably an earlier work of his, to the aphorism of Hippocrates. This is the father of medicine, who there was an extant work of his aphorisms. And he wrote a commentary to this, similar to basically the commentary he wrote to the Mishnah. He wrote, this is number 10, extracts from the treatises of Galen. Galen wrote over 100 treatises. He read them through, and just as he did in the Mishnah Torah, he reorganized it. So it was a synopsis of Galen in a very organized form. He wrote a treatise on hemorrhoids, a treatise on cohabitation. This is also written for the Sultan. Medical Response, this is the last work that he wrote also to the Sultan. And finally, a glossary of drug names. It's a compendium of pharmaceuticals. And as the commentary is, that it showed the Rambam's vast knowledge, not only in Arabic, but in Greek and other languages, that he was able to cull through the sources the various available drugs that existed then in medieval times. In these short minutes, I would like to give an overview of the Rambam as a doctor. What did he teach us? The first thing we see from the Rambam, this is an idea that he writes in his commentary to the Mishnah, in the Mishnah Torah, and also in his medical responsa, that the purpose of being well, and treating the sick is not only for the physical component of man, but the spiritual component as well. As the Rambam writes here, this is on the handout, it's on the first page in paragraph A, the purpose of maintaining bodily health is to acquire wisdom. If you're sick, you cannot think. And in fact, the Rambam extends this in the Mishneh Torah. One of the mitzvahs of the Torah is v'halachta b'drachav, you should walk in God's ways. From Talmudic sources, we know that it involves bestowing kindness on others, helping others in need, treating the sick, clothing those who don't have clothes, cheering those that need to be cheered. The Rambam extended this, that the Darkei Hashem, the ways of God, not only refer to magnanimity, largesse, extending goodwill, but to leading a good life. And he takes this that one is required, therefore, to lead a life which leads to spirituality. And therefore, since one has to be healthy if you're plagued with illnesses, as the Rambam said, since having the body healthy and sound constitutes a fulfillment of the commandment to walk in the ways of God, for it is impossible to understand or know anything of the knowledge of the Creator when one is sick, it is obligatory for a person to distance himself from things that harm the body and accustom himself to things that heal and fortify it. And according to the Rambam, therefore, that the practice of medicine is raised from a simple craft to a higher calling. It's very revealing, and this is in paragraph C. This was written shortly before the Rambam's death, and this was written, this medical response to the Sultan, complaining about the Rambam's own poor health that he suffered. You have to realize how much they were displaced, and he was traveling under very, very difficult circumstances. He says, "My health hinders me. My old age hinders me from many pleasures." And he concludes, "I don't mean the pleasures, I don't mean real physical pleasures. Rather, I mean noble accomplishments, the greatest and highest of which is the dedication to the service of our Lord." He looked that being healthy is a prerequisite for being spiritual. Another component of the Rambam's view of medicine is the relationship between body and spirit. The Rambam's view of medicine, of course, was that of Galen. This is before what we know of cellular pathology, of microbiology. They felt that medicine and health depended on the humors. There were four humors that controlled health. And the Rambam writes, as in the bottom of the first page, just as body humors influence man's virtues, so do virtues influence humors. Let's hear the role of psychology in health. I can just briefly touch upon these things. But on the next page in paragraph D, I'd like to read to you. Again, very revealing. As for the effect of psychic moods, it is generally acknowledged that the impact of mental suffering, agitation, obstinacy is to impair mental activity and physical well-being. So much so that one's appetite for food is completely lost when in mental anguish, fear, mourning, or distress. In such condition, a man cannot even use his voice properly because his agitation affects his respiratory organs, cannot exercise them at will. He goes on to describe the deleterious influence of being depressed. And he concludes, on the other hand, gaiety and liveliness have the opposite effect. They gladden the heart, stimulate the movement of the blood, and degree of mental activity stemming from such condition is in some cases among the highest. Now, it makes sense to be happy. Another element of this is exercise. And in his aphorisms, he points out the connection between exercise and mental health and physical health. And he says, in a quote, "The most beneficial of all types of exercise is physical gymnastics, to the point that the soul becomes influenced and rejoices, because emotions of happiness often suffice to heal just by their presence. Thus, rejoicing and happiness alone make many people's illness milder." Another factor of exercise, of course, is just general good health. It was his suggestion that one exercises before meals. He says this in aphorisms and in his Yada Chazaka, in the fourth chapter of Hilchos Deos. He describes the role of exercise. And he suggests it should be before meals. And it's his feeling, you know, that if one eats well and one exercises well, in the absence of anything else, of any traumatic, any drought, plague, the person should be well. Another interesting thing of the advice to those who want to begin an exercise program. Again, this is on page 2, section 3, paragraph C. "When our master mentioned that he's overcome," this was written to the Sultan, "with fatigue and weariness after physical exercise." The cause for this is you're just out of shape. It's a suspension and omission of regular exercise. He's, do it gradually. Build yourself up. Eventually you'll reach an optimum level, and then you could exercise regularly. Ecology was very high on the Rambam's priorities. Not only clean water, good food, but clean air as well. Barry Commoner would love him. On page 3, on the top paragraph, he says, "The concern," I have in bold print, and again, you could read this at the length of time, "the concern for clean air is the foremost rule in preserving the health of one's body and soul." I don't know how much the Rambam charged for his services, but he was a very reluctant doctor. And on page 3, we have various quotes from the Rambam about that one should be careful not to call the doctor too often. In most cases, the body takes care of itself. And when you over-medicate, you're basically crippling the body. So let the body work it out. Here, I just want to quote you on page 4. Here, this is on paragraph D. It says, "The rule laid out by the great masters of medicine is the following. Anything that might be cured with diet should not be treated by any other means. When this fails, mild drugs should be used, and anything which might be cured with simple remedies should not be treated with combined remedies. And even then, only the least complicated should be used." I want all the doctors here to hear this. He had special advice for physicians. Basically, up until now, this was for the patient. One is, and again, I am just touching upon this in this in greater length at the, you know, in the notes. And paragraph B in section 6, "The physician should not treat the disease, but the patient." Everything changes, and as he says in the end of the first paragraph here in section 6, "Any sick individual presents new problems. One can never say that one disease is just like the other." I remember in the, I don't know if your memory goes back that far, I remember the 1968 presidential campaign that Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew were running for president, and Hubert Humphrey and Ed Muskie were running on the Democratic ticket. And there was a on the radio, there was the following commercial, and you heard a heartbeat, you know, ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. The presidency is one heartbeat, the vice presidency is one heartbeat away from the presidency. Ba-bum, ba-bum. After all, this was only some 5 years after the death of President Kennedy. Ba-bum, ba-bum. Would you elect a man who admits he knows nothing about foreign policy? Ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. Who says if you've seen one ghetto, you've seen them all? Ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. And then paid for, then very quickly in hushed tones, paid for is by the committee to re-elect, to elect Humphrey Muskie. This was a an anti-Spiro Agnew commercial, but basically it's saying if you've seen one ghetto, you haven't seen them all. There are various levels of human suffering. The Rambam says there are various patients. Don't assume that this is just a textbook case. Study the patient, not the disease. He was also very indignant of the fact that very often, what was the common practice in Egypt, that patients would not just go to one physician. They would run from one to the other. And very often, the one physician who's treating the patient doesn't realize that at the same time, he's asking advice from another one and another one and another. And he lists that there are four ills that result of a patient seeking advice from too many doctors. One is ultimately the patient becomes the arbiter of his own of his own fate. And after all, the patient is not a doctor. How is really he to know what is right or wrong? The other case is that the doctor prescribes something and then speaks to the patient, doesn't realize that the patient really hasn't followed his orders. And there's no way for the doctor with this follow-up to know that really what he's prescribed has worked or hasn't worked. Once he does find out about the other doctors are on the case, generally this is a means of just he criticizes the other doctor. He's the one who botched it up. And he doesn't feel any responsibility to really treat the patient. And he ends off that therefore he would not take great pains to guide the patient according to his best knowledge because he knows others which would also be consulted. And he felt as the proper thing is to have a doctor see the patient from beginning to end. One thing he does suggest, though, is that there are multiple doctors. They should be consulted jointly on a case and therefore pool their resources, and this is on page 5. And he says that it is a boon. And at the end of the paragraph, is on page 5, paragraph D, however, when several come together, they remind and assist each other to arrive at the desired end, so the best medical treatment is assured by use of the collegium, through consulting together. This, of course, is if, of course, they get along together and they cooperate. If it's just going to be a shouting match between doctors, he says, the best thing is keep away from the whole process. And he goes on to say, why do doctors disagree? Fascinating. This is all in his treatise of asthma. And this is, here's is on paragraph E, in the beginning of page 5. I'd like to add a fourth cause why physicians quarrel. And this goes way beyond the idea of physicians, and it really touches us in day-to-day life. This is the force of habit, the tendency to cling to preconceived ideas, the inertia of one's acquired habits, irrespective of whether they are things or ideas. Man is inclined to profess those opinions in which he was reared and which became a habit with him, a second nature. Another point of view is abhorrent to him, even if it surpasses his own accuracy. If one is familiar with the history of medicine, one knows the difficulties that Louis Pasteur went through until he convinced his colleagues about the theory of sickness due to microbes. They just couldn't believe this. And when finally Louis Pasteur's theories were accepted, I believe it was Bernard Christensen, who developed the idea of vitamins. The beriberi was curable through diet. And again, this is the medical establishment in his day felt, no, this is the cause of all disease is bacteria or viruses, microbes. And again, it took much, much convincing for them to change their ideas. Nothing is new. This is fascinating. Even the Rambam's day, how he viewed this. The Rambam, by the way, not only was a student of medicine, but he experimented as well. And in the 25th chapter of his aphorism, he takes Galen to task, not only for his contradictions, but what he felt were inaccuracies and blatant lies. I'd just like to give just quickly a sampler of some of the things that the Rambam spoke about in his medical treatises. One was diabetes. This is really... diabetes, Galen rarely speaks about, is rare in Europe. However, the Rambam says, here in Egypt, in the course of approximately 10 years, I've seen more than 20 people have suffered from this illness. This brings one to the conclusion this illness occurs mostly in warm countries, perhaps the waters of the Nile. He wasn't sure, because of their sweetness may play a role in this. The translator of the aphorism suggested that this is the first place in literature that sweetness has been implicated as a role in diabetes. In paragraph C, there's a quote. This is actually a quote from Galen in his aphorisms. But the translator suggested that this is something new. That this was not seen before. But in how he saw the reading and how we translated, it seems to suggest the Rambam understood that there was a revolution, that there was a circulation of blood. This is some 500 years before Harvey. And yet, the Rambam speaks about a complete revolution. Just to quickly read the beginning of his... This is from the beginning of the Rambam's work on poisons and their antidotes. When someone is bitten, immediate care should be taken to tie the spot above the wound as fast as possible to prevent poison from spreading throughout the body. In the meantime, another person should make cuts with a black lancet directly above the wound. Wound suck vigorously with his mouth and spit out. Sounds familiar. The Rambam goes on to say that before you've eaten, when you've woke up in the morning, the spit is a much greater effect to neutralize the as we know, the enzymes in the spit are greater to neutralize the poison than after one has eaten. Before, it's advisable to disinfect the mouth, and care should be taken that the sucking person has no wound in his mouth or rotten teeth, because of course if they go directly into the bloodstream, it could be fatal. The Rambam, as we've said before, was very concerned not only with healing, but with prophylactic medicine. In terms of snake bites, and this, to finish this section, beginning of page 6, it is therefore advisable that man should handle these measures prophylactically and fumigate all places infested by any kind of poisonous creatures, for the superiority of Homo sapiens lies in that he can choose the means whereby he may forestall, treat, and cure the ills that afflict the body. In other words, the best thing is to fumigate. Make sure you don't have snakes is the best cure. However, there is no absolute security but in trust in the grace of God the Exalted. And again, here we have the Rambam, not only the doctor, but the rabbi. The Rambam was very busy when the new sultan came to power. In fact, he was unable at that point to learn to write. His productive years in terms of halacha were behind him. In the year 1199, the Rambam was 64 already, wasn't a young man. He describes a regular day. He had received a letter from Shmuel ibn Tibun, who was a major translator of his works from Arabic into Hebrew. And he wanted to consult directly with the Rambam. And the Rambam told him, I simply don't have any time. And if you think your schedules, you seem a bit harried with your schedule, I'd like to read this section from the Rambam. This is a letter that he wrote. I dwell at Fostat, this is old Cairo, and the Sultan resides in Kahira, Cairo. These two places are two Sabbath days' journey, about a mile and a half distance from each other. This is before they built the freeway. My duties to the Sultan are very heavy. I am obliged to visit him every day early in the morning, and when he or any of his children or any of his inmates of his harem are indisposed, I dare not quit Kahira, but must stay during the greater part of the day in the palace. Also frequently happens that one or two of the royal officers fall sick and must attend to their healings. Hence, as a rule, I repair to Kahira very early in the day, and even if nothing unusually happens, I do not return to Mizr until the afternoon. This is the Fostep. Then I am almost dying with hunger. I find the antechamber filled with people, both Jews and Gentiles, nobles and common people, judges and bailiffs, friends and foes, a mixed multitude who wait the time of my return. I dismount from my animal, wash my hands, go forth to my patients, and entreat them to bear with me while I partake of some slight refreshment, the only meal I take in 24 hours. Then I attend to my patients and write prescriptions and directions for their several ailments. Patients go in and out until nightfall, and sometimes even, I solemnly assure you, till 2 hours or more in the night. I converse with and prescribe for them while laying down from sheer fatigue, and when night falls, I am so exhausted I can scarcely speak. In consequence of this, no Israelite can have any private interview with me except on Shabbos. On that day, the whole congregation, at least the majority of the members, come to me after the morning service, where I instruct them as their proceedings during the whole week. We study together a little until noon when they depart. Some of them return and read with me after the afternoon services until evening prayers. In this manner, I spend the days. I've related to you only part of what you would see if you were to visit me. Evidently, he had a very busy schedule. And yet, despite all of this, the Rambam was exceedingly humble. In his treatise in Asma, we have a sense of what the Rambam was as a person. Most of his works, we see the Rambam as a scholar. But in here, was his personally writing to this nobleman. Having heard all of this, Your Highness should no way conclude, this is he had written about various ways to control his asthma, that I am the right man in whose hands you may place your body and soul for treatment. Heaven be my witness that I myself know well that I belong to those who are not perfect in this art of medicine and shrink from it for lack of adequate experience, because it is enormously difficult to attain its end. Again, heaven be my witness that the words that I say are not motivated by any modesty, such as pious men resort to when deliberately understating their knowledge, even if they're experts in their vocation, and making little of their own deeds, even when highly diligent and active. I state the truth as it is. The Rambam felt he was wholly inadequate. We had originally scheduled that I speak on Maimonides and Nachmanides. Because of the lateness of the hour, I forgo an in-depth treatment of Nachmanides. I would just give you a minute or two, an overview. And this is something which you could read on your own. As far as I know, we have nothing from even though the Ramban was a physician by profession, he left no medical works. He alludes to the knowledge that he acquired through medicine in his commentary of the Torah. But his greatest contribution to medicine was in the field of medical ethics. His work, Torah Sa'odom, literally the guide of man, which deals with sickness and death and mourning, was really the framework for the Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch written by Yosef Karo, his treatment of the subject. In fact, his predecessor, this is the Tur, written by Yaakov ben Osher, the predecessor of the Shulchan Aruch, took almost verbatim the Torah Sa'odom in those sections which were applicable. Most of our knowledge of medical ethics we owe to the Ramban. And again, I would just touch the headings to see that where the Ramban's opinions, not just for the most part Torah Sa'odom, the framework is quoting from Talmudic sources, but he adds his own comments. And he deals with questions when doctors disagree. who to listen to? Is a fetus considered a life in terms of saving that life? How much life is deemed worthwhile to save or to extend? What is the responsibility to treat a patient? What's done in cases of malpractice? How much should a physician charge? And I'd just like to end with a quote, again, a classic from the Ramban, and this is a situation where the physician overcharged the patient because the patient was desperate, and the Ramban maintains he has to pay the physician because no charge, even though he maintains that a physician is doing a mitzvah and should not take money for the actual sharing of knowledge, only for the physical labor involved or the time that he took off where he could be making money elsewhere. But if the physician did charge, the Ramban includes, if he agreed to pay an exorbitant fee to the physicians on page 10, he's required to pay that fee. This is because he was charged for the physician's wisdom, which is priceless. And I'm sure all of you here can agree.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.